Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing programs to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
Houston Baptist University is a very special event, November the 6th, with Kay Warren, the wife of Pastor Rick Warren, Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California. Two beloved people, and one of their dear friends is our guest today, Dr. Matthew Stanford, the CEO of Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston. Dr. Stanford also serves as adjunct professor of psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine and at the Methodist Hospital Institute for Academic Medicine. As an author, researcher, and educator, Dr. Stanford focuses on the interplay between psychology and faith issues. Boy, that is an important topic, isn't it?
It is.
You have such a unique background, and Hope and Healing here in Houston is helping so many people. Just give us a synopsis of Hope and Healing.
Yeah, the Hope and Healing Center and Institute sits on the campus of St. Martin's Episcopal Church in the Galleria area. We are a fully comprehensive mental health clinic. We see people that have serious mental illness, provide a range of services for them from support groups all the way to psychiatric care. Our services are free. The majority of people that we see don't have any resources to pay for their care. But one of our primary programs is that we are involved in training faith communities to be part of the mental health care system and really an entry point for people to begin to receive care. Because in the United States today, people are more likely to go to a clergy when they're struggling with mental health issues before they go to a mental health care provider or physician. So our thought is if we can equip faith communities, then later school systems, and then even later larger businesses, people will be able to access mental health care wherever they are.
And mental health is not the stigma it used to be, where everybody ignored it. We have a mental health issue with the iGen generation.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a significant mental health problem in this country. Mental health issues are increasing, particularly in younger individuals. The suicide rates in 18 to 25 have spiked dramatically over the last few years. And you see every day, you see more and more older adolescents and young adults that are struggling with these problems, yet they have problems accessing care. That's one of the biggest issues in the United States today is that a majority of people that have mental health care problems, both children and adolescents and adults, do not receive any treatment. I mean, it's an unbelievable and frightening statistic to imagine saying, for instance, a condition like cancer, a majority of people did not receive care would be unbelievable. But a majority of people with these mental health conditions receive no treatment. Even though there are incredible resources, there simply aren't enough resources, and there is no clear pathway for them to receive care. And that's why at the Hope and Healing Center and Institute, we really feel like the church is an answer to this because, as I said, people are more likely to go there first before they go to try to access some type of actual professional care.
And that's an important fact that often is ignored or people don't know, that a church, a faith institution, is that first contact point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people recognize, even those who aren't affiliated with faith communities or aren't people who necessarily believe in God, they recognize that a faith community is a place that's accessible, it's free, and there are people there that are supposed to care for you. And so people might not exactly understand what they're struggling with. They just know that their life is in chaos or they're struggling with something, and they know someone there will talk to them, will show them some encouragement, will offer them some hope, and that's where they go. Unfortunately, what the research shows is that most clergy, most ministry staff are really not equipped to recognize mental health care problems, and few make referrals. And when they do make referrals, they rarely make the right referral. But I'm not sure why we would expect them with no training to be able to do that. It would be like expecting the cashier at Walmart when you're buying your groceries to recognize you have depression and then give you the right thing, the right referral. So it's, what we want to do is we want to equip them to do that. And I would say, as you mentioned, a younger generation, youth pastors, college pastors, they are at that age of onset of these illnesses. I mean, half of all mental health problems are in place by 14 years old,
yeah.
three quarters by 24 years old. And so those clergy are at a pivotal point and really could serve as an incredible gatekeeper to the mental health care system.
HBU is deeply committed to the mental health crisis, as is Dr. Stanford at Hope and Healing. HBU has launched the Global Mental Health Care Center, aggregated some outstanding curricula that's available residentially at 7502 Fondren, but it's available digitally, online, all over the world. And much is going to be made of that initiative, led by our president, Dr. Robert Sloan, who has such a heart for men and women to be whole and healed. He understands, and it touches me that he does. You know, in the El Paso Dayton shooting world, we see mental health almost weekly on the news, the reality of it. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, Matthew, but and we're going to talk about Kay Warren here in just a second. But when you see the shootings, and it certainly it was in El Paso and Dayton, you often see these little white crosses erected mm-hmm. and the names put on of who was killed. Well, what a lot of people don't know that the guy who builds those crosses is a carpenter from Illinois. He's a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And the minute one of these shootings happens, he gets in his truck, drives to the city, builds the crosses, hugs the neck, and then he goes on. His name is Greg Zanis, and he has now built 26,000 crosses. So when we talk about difficulty in this country, we talk about suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, violent ideation, we're not talking about danger stranger. It may be somebody in your family, somebody that lives on the street you live on. And there are people that are making a difference. Now, you are very close friends with Rick and Kay Warren, and I think everybody knows who they are. Rick Warren, author of Purpose Driven Life, wonderful pastor of Saddleback Church. Just, I love these guys. I remember, believe it or not, it'll date me, but in 1980, I spoke at Costa Mesa High School for a pastor that didn't wear socks and wore a Hawaiian shirt. And his name was Rick Warren, just a young guy starting out. And I remember that day so distinctly, the love he had for people. And it's just not stopped. They brought so much to America and the world. They've responded to the AIDS crisis in Africa. But something happened in their family. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, the Warrens have a number of children, but one of their children, Matthew, struggled for most of his life with borderline personality disorder and at times would become suicidal, had to be hospitalized many times. I know that Rick and Kay took him to the best psychiatrist, the best therapist, the best facilities around the world to try to receive treatment, and he had good times, but mostly bad times, and then ultimately he took his life. It was very tragic for them. Kay and I met originally when we were sitting on a Southern Baptist Convention committee to try to develop some mental health initiatives in the Southern Baptist Convention, and it was not too long after their son had passed away. And so subsequent to that, she and I have kind of a running joke how many times we end up together at mental health and faith conferences at different churches around the country, speaking about mental health and faith. I had been doing this for some time, and really it was difficult to get some momentum. Unfortunately, or fortunately in some sense perhaps, the passing of their son Matthew really shined a light on people that were respected within the faith community. So that there really a conversation began, you know. So some the other high profile suicides that had occurred, some pastors that had taken their lives, another prominent pastor whose daughter took their life, really, and the Warrens' willingness to go on to Piers Morgan, to go on to television and talk about the journey that they had gone through and the struggles that they had had, and the reality and the normality of mental illness, really, I think, began, or I should say, moved the conversation within the faith community to a different point. And I really think even have kind of pushed the conversation within the country to a different point. And so it's very exciting to hear that Kay will be coming, and I'm excited to see her and to be with her and to speak about how, faith communities can really be an answer to the mental health crisis we have here in this country.
Matthew, let's talk about Rick and Kay's boy. You said he had borderline personality disorder.
Yes, that's what Kay has told me and what many of the physicians felt.
Okay, so tell us from a clinical standpoint, what is that?
Yeah, borderline personality disorder obviously is a personality disorder. Individuals who have that personality disorder tend to have a lot of emotional instability. It's very difficult for them to kind of control their emotions. They'll kind of swing around from highs to lows. They have a lot of kind of worthlessness, and they feel very unvalued. So they're struggling between kind of depressive states and then kind of more normal states. They're often highly suicidal. They also are very disruptive or damaging in the context of relational issues. So they will become, in some sense, overly clingy in a relationship, like kind of overlove you, and then in the next minute turn around and kind of assassinate you or kind of destroy the relationship, by doing some very kind of ugly things. They're very, very impulsive. But really the core component of borderline personality disorder is this idea that you really have no value. You feel as if you have no value. So part of the relational kind of sabotage that you do is to really convince yourself and others that indeed you should not be loved. You should not be a person that you have a relationship with. A very high percentage of individuals with borderline personality disorder, maybe as high as 15 to 20%, will die as a result of suicide. They also can have some kind of depersonalization or almost delusional situations in which they kind of feel separate from their body or lose track of reality. It's a horrible illness. It's very difficult to treat. And one of the reasons it's so difficult to treat is because the individual usually is fighting you the entire time against the treatment. They don't want to get the treatment.
Very much like schizophrenia, maybe.
There is some correlates, especially the delusional aspects. There are times where they seem to not be within the same reality, although it's not a psychotic disorder. They don't go to that extent. Uh-huh. But again, very difficult to treat. In fact, I can say when I was in graduate school, which was in the mid to late 80s, we were actually taught at that time there was no treatment, there was no hope for anyone with borderline personality disorder. And at this point, we do have a treatment. We have what's called dialectical behavior therapy, which is a therapeutic intervention that we actually offer at the Hope and Healing Center, specifically for people with borderline personality disorder. That's very effective, although it's very intensive and it takes a long time. And that, in addition to some different medications, a person can find relief and recover. It's a long process, it's difficult, but at least now we do have some resources for people that are struggling with those problems.
You know, we see suicide in the Bible. I mean, we know Judas committed suicide, and we know that some of the prophets of God actually asked God to kill them. Going back to Matthew Warren, I mean, how old was he? Where was he? And you know Kay in a way that I think is very kindred spirit. Mm-hmm. And so first, where was he? How did it happen? She's going to tell the whole story.
He was at
his
home, not with the war. He lived on his own. He was in his late 20s, early 30s, if I remember correctly, and he was just at his home, and the Warrens weren't able to get a hold of him, and they were concerned, because he had had times of suicidality in the past, and were not able to get a hold of him, and went to the home, and had the police come, and then he had taken his life with a weapon, with a gun.
Mm-hmm. Kay Warren is going to be at the Founders Convocation at Houston Baptist University, November the 6th. Be sure to mark that date. It is going to be absolutely jammed here.
And Kate's very open about...
Tell us, I mean, that's what you were sharing.
She's extremely open. You know, I often will describe Kay as... she's very raw when you think of it in the context of...
And what do you mean by that?
Well, what I would say is, you know, a lot of times when you hear a pastor's wife, especially a Baptist pastor's wife...
Right.
And for you Baptist pastor's wives out there, no insult intended, but it tends to be a little bit measured and a little careful and...
A little sanitized?
A little bit, yeah, you know, and... And Kay really tells it the way it is. I mean, she tells, it's a tragic tale. It's a tragic story. It's a suffering young man who desperately loved the Lord and a family who dedicated their lives to helping others who are just destroyed by his passing and a mental illness that, you know, we tend to maybe focus on that event of his passing, but you know, years and years, decades of mental illness and suffering. And, you know, and she lays that all out. She's very open with that. And, you know, she lets you know that, you know, just because you're a believer doesn't mean that the world is all rainbow and sunshine. It does mean you have a Savior that that is with you, that empowers you, that's transforming you, that's going to be with you for eternity. But while we live in a fallen world, we... deal with the suffering and pain and tragedy of that fallen world. You know, she's a real breath of fresh air when she shares. I know it's probably very painful for her, but I appreciate her openness. And I think her openness and her husband Rick's openness has really, as I said, pushed the conversation forward. And I think made a difference in the context of breaking stigma and helping others to receive the care they may need.
What will it be like for those that are here on November 6th when she shares that story? I got to imagine it's dead quiet.
Yeah, and I think that also, I think people, they get a, you know, you get a little bit better feel for what it's like to be near someone who is a real survivor of tragedy. It's, you know, we hear about these things as if they happen somewhere else. More than 40,000 people a year die from suicide.
Right.
And so, you know, what's interesting about that number is that, you know, it's about the same number of people that die from suicide every year that die from the flu. But every time flu season comes, we have, you know, advertisements on TV and get your flu shot and we put out sanitizing things. And, you know, if it's a certain strain of flu, we get all kind of crazy and we're, you know, but the same number of people every single year passing away from suicide, yet we almost never talk about it. So I think what they'll take away from it is that this is a reality that's occurring all around us, that this happens to good people, that this happens to believers, this happens to people that are following God, and that, you know, it's an absolute tragedy that is preventable to some extent. It's not that the Warrens did anything wrong. They did everything right. Mm-hmm. It's just that if we were a more educated society about mental illness, if we made resources more available, if we made them affordable and accessible, more individuals would be able to receive the care that they need. And we could see that number go down. But as we learn from the Warren story, even when you do everything right, you know, death by suicide is not necessarily something we can predict and not necessarily something we can stop.
Kay Warren will be here on November the 6th at 11 a.m., Founders Convocation, Houston Baptist University. You need to make sure you come early to get in. I want to just ask you, in one of the myths of suicide, it's talking about suicide causes suicide. Mm-hmm. I mean, dealt with that with you for years. In fact, the opposite is true.
Absolutely. The research shows just the opposite is true, that, you know, when you're doing a suicide assessment or when you're training individuals to be more suicide fluent or equipped, you tell them if somebody's giving you the feeling that they may be going to hurt themselves, you need to very matter of fact ask them, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Are you thinking about, you know, attempting suicide? That actually makes it less likely that they will harm themselves, because they will likely engage you in a conversation about it. Even if they are saying, no, I'm not, and they're just denying that they are and they were, they still are less likely. There's this idea, as you mentioned, the myth, that you put it into someone's mind. Mm-hmm. It really, in a sense, is the other way around. It's almost as if you take it out of their mind by bringing it out into the light, bringing it out into the open. They're much, much less likely to harm themselves.
I want to ask you, when Kay shares that story about Matthew's death by suicide, does she share how Rick and her responded and what coping mechanisms they've used?
She typically shares quite a bit about her own response and how it affected her personally as a mother and also as a believer and as a pastor's wife. How did that, you know, how does your son who suffered most of his life with an illness and now has died as a result of suicide, how does that affect your faith? Where does that leave you and God? You know, is God still a source for you of encouragement, of comfort, of joy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's very open with that and she shares that. And, you know, not to give away the story, but he is. But it's not as clean and simple of a story as we like to try to make it out to be. You know, I think those of us who haven't been personally touched by suicide, for instance, might think, oh, well, you just need to hang on to the Lord and, you know, God will comfort you and, you know, look at the Psalms. And you know, those are kind of trite answers for a tragedy like that. And in fact, really the best thing for us is to put our hand over our mouth and just be present and let God and that individual work it out. And Kay has a good story of how she was able to work through her faith. And you know, I think she might even say she maybe is closer to God today. Not that that is, I've never been one to say, you know, let's look at those tragedies in our lives and try to find the good thing that happened. And then now we can look on that side. And I think on this side of heaven, we really don't know the good that God works these things out mm-hmm. to. They hurt and they tear. And I don't think that, you know, something like that would, you know, a believer would wish that on their worst enemy. Mm-hmm. There is a life after. And I think that's really what she's able to share from a perspective that few people have.
Kay Warren is going to be at HBU on November the 6th at 11 a.m. in Founders Convocation. It was the exact day Billy Graham was here at Houston Baptist College about 60 years ago. Very, very special day. It's going to be memorable. You know, Dr. Robert Sloan, who we both love and admire, and I think you know a lot about Dr. Sloan as well from your time when you worked with him. It was brave of him to step out and to address the mental health crisis and to aggregate a curriculum together mm-hmm. in HBU's Mental Health Global Outreach. How do you feel about what we're doing as a university of higher learning in that particular area, the mental health space?
I mean, one of the biggest problems in mental health care today is that we simply have a lack of providers. I was just looking at data from the Houston area, the Harris County, which is here in Houston, just last week. And in Harris County, we have one psychiatrist for every 8,500 people.
Wow.
You know, we're the fourth largest city in the country. We have one of the greatest medical centers in the world here. If you have cancer, there's no greater hospital in the world than MD Anderson. You know, we have one of the greatest psychiatric hospitals here in Menninger. Yet, we are lacking horribly. So to see a university step out and say, you know, number one, we're going to step into the fray of mental health and we're going to have an emphasis in that. We're going to offer a whole set of degrees at varying levels with varying emphases and focus is important and exciting to see. I think another thing that's very exciting is to see that that HBU and Dr. Sloan are willing to say, maybe we can't just do it the way we used to do it. Because if we just keep doing it the same way we've always done it, we're probably never gonna get there. You know, I know that I often use the example of nurses. You know, my entire life, there's always been a shortage of nurses. You know, my father used to tell me, you know, you want to get a job, be a nurse, just open up the Houston Chronicle on a Sunday and there are 100 ads in there. And so, you know, over time, they've dramatically changed the way nurses are educated. They've changed the places that offer that education. They're, you know, every junior college now has a nursing program. They're online nursing program. So there's been transformations in the way they're trained and certified so that we can get to that point. With HBU's initiative, you begin to see that kind of a thought process in that, you know, we need more of these. This will make a difference. We have to make sure it's quality training, but we can't just do it the way we've always done it. We can't expect everyone to be able to come to the campus, sit on the campus for 4 years or whatever, and be able to get to the levels that we need. And so I like the fact that there's this online aspect to it, there's a global aspect in the sense that people are able to access it from anywhere, because this isn't just a United States problem. I worked in Northern Africa for years, and you know, mental health care providers are needed everywhere. When I was in working in Libya, there were 30 or so psychiatrists in the entire country.
Wow.
For 6.5 million people. So this is a necessity everywhere, and it's exciting to see this being done. And I can see that this is really only the beginning. That there's an opportunity to add in additional certifications, additional training, even at higher levels. And really, this could be not just transformative for the city of Houston, but transformative for HBU and the country as a whole.
Well, I totally agree. And I just, with you, applaud President Sloan for just a tremendous, heartfelt initiative. When Dr. Sloan and I spoke about Kay coming, he sent me to see her down in Alabama. And we sat in her little green room trailer, and I showed her what we were doing in the mental health center. She was just, really impressed with it. And she said to me, "Jerry, you're in Houston. There's one person I want you to connect with. It's Matthew Stanford." And I came home and did exactly what she told me to do. I called you. And I've been to Hope and Healing, and you really can't understand what you're doing till you go there and see hundreds of people and all the ways that you're making a difference. HopeandHealingCenter.org. Make sure you check it out. Matthew Stanford's going to join us on November 6th with Kay Warren. It's going to be a super event. I want to just wrap up by just saying that it takes a special husband, particularly when you have something as intimate and personal as the death by suicide of your son, to allow your wife to go share. And she's going everywhere. And I remember she told me in the little green room, she said, "We've been heavily involved with AIDS in Africa, but we're praying about the future of our lives and what we should do." And why the connection between Kay Warren and you? And what, in closing remarks, do you feel about the generous, humble spirit of a Rick Warren to let his wife go and so boldly share?
Yeah, I think one of the good things about how they've dealt with this is that, a family has to understand when a suicide has occurred in the family that each person is going to have to grieve in their own way. And some of those people are going to want to grieve, and part of their grieving process is going to be talking about what has occurred. And be that maybe not at the level or on the platform that Kay talks about it, but talking about it to others so that it can be understood and can be prevented by others. Whereas other people are going to grieve more, within themselves. And that's perfectly appropriate. So I think that understanding is something that the Warrens really do. They understand that they each have to deal with this in a different way. And they also each have different platforms. And Kay, obviously, her passion and her ministry even at Saddleback Church is for those that are mentally ill. Kay and I, we have a great relationship in that, honestly, I think that, when I first met her, I kind of, she was like kind of like a Christian superstar. But I think, honestly, we kind of, in a weird sense, kind of feel sorry for each other because, we're out there on the road like some kind of, vacuum cleaner salesman trying to get people to listen and trying to tell people, look, these people are coming to faith communities and they are in horrible distress and suffering and God is sending them to us and we have to be prepared. We have to be involved. And I think it's not that people were saying, no, you're wrong. It's just that they were just kind of apathetic. And I think really that's been kind of the bond between us. And it's been, she's always been a good listening ear to me when I And you know, I would say that she could get up and tell a good hour-long story of how many times Matt Stanford has sat down with her and just poured out like his frustration with churches and the church as a whole, and why can't we just love people that have mental health problems? And she's really kept me going a lot. So I hope that I might have added a little bit in for her, but you know, she's a real inspiration to me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stanford. And you know, we both acknowledge that the new Gideon Center at HBU with Dr. Eric Johnson, a friend of yours, fantastic counseling apparatus that has been launched, and Gideon will be involved, Dr. Johnson as well, on November the 6th when Kay Warren comes to HBU. You can learn more about it at hbu.edu. Check out events. And remember, November the 6th, 11 a.m. Thanks, Doc.
Thank you.
Here at HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.